Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is Susan Crandall, a freelance writer and editor based in Cornwall-on-Hudson, who spent three decades editing magazines like Travel and Leisure, Smart Money. After 6 years as editor-in-chief at More magazine, Crandall quit and soon after published the book Thinking About Tomorrow, Rejuvenating Yourself at Midlife. A Capital Region native and graduate of Middlebury College, who also earned a pilot's license, Crandall now works as consulting editor for WorkReimagined.com. Susan Crandall, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Alan.
So who are you?
Who am I?
Yeah.
I'm a reluctant reinventor, which is why I decided to write about it. I was not a natural at all at making a life change, and yet I found I wanted a different kind of life than commuting 3.5 hours every day to New York. And so I changed my life from being a magazine editor, and which is kind of the top of the totem pole in the industry, to becoming a freelance writer, where I now sometimes write for my old assistant. So it was a big game change in life, but one of the best things I've ever done.
I hesitate to ask you this, but can you make a living?
Yeah, but I do call my new life 1/3 the money, 3 times the fun.
Interesting. What do you mean by that?
Well, I make a lot less money. I make 1/3. I might make 1/4 of my old salary in some years. But my husband, who's also a writer, and I live in a little house overlooking the Hudson River. People used to say
just
to me,
a little house overlooking the Hudson River. You sound like you're rich. Are you rich?
No, we're not.
Okay.
But when I worked in New York, people would say, "Where's your country house?" And I would say, "I live in it."
Yeah.
You know, and so we have, you know, one place that we live, and I have worked as a travel writer for many years, and we call that lifestyle helper. You know, when people send you places, you don't choose the places that you go, but you get to see a lot of the world. And so, you know, life is a little simpler, and life is really, really good. It's nice to spend the day with my husband.
Well, but it sounds like you had the perfect life working on travel magazines and going all over the world and doing all of those things. I think my wife, the lovely Roselle, would certainly like to have that job. Why reinvent it?
Well, actually, going back to the Travel and Leisure job, I lost that job.
Oh.
I was the number two, and a new editor came in and said, "I would like to have my own number two. Thank you very much." So that job went away, which is very typical of what happens in publishing. You know, sometimes the bear eats you, sometimes you eat the bear. But I actually traveled less as an editor at Travel and Leisure when I was sending writers out on assignments than when I became a freelance writer, and suddenly I was the one taking the trips. Smaller paycheck, but other rewards.
How, Susan Crandall, should we decide that our lives need rejiggering?
I think you feel an itch. I mean, if you're doing something you love, you get up in the morning happy to go to work, you're pleased with the rest of your life, you're good. I mean, it doesn't have to happen. But what I've seen is that with people living longer and being healthier, the nice extra years seem to kind of happen in the middle, where we're in our 50s or our 60s or even our 70s and feeling very vital and relatively young. And then people start to think, "I've paid for my kids to go to college. I have a little bit more time, a little bit more money than I used to have. What am I going to do with my life? Maybe I want to leave a legacy. Maybe I want to do work that gives back." But people sometimes feel an itch. And if you feel that itch, you want to scratch.
But Susan, aren't people, especially in this economy, scared to give up work, regular work, because they're scared, especially when you get a little bit older, that you won't have anything, as our mothers used to say, to fall back on?
I think you're absolutely right. I wrote a book about reinvention 5 or 6 years ago, and at that time, it was people kicking up their heels and saying, "I have resources, I have money, I have time, and I'm going to make a choice," and marching into it a little bit more boldly. And I think this is the era now, since, 2008, 2009, of the involuntary reinventor. on Work Reimagined.
I like it. Involuntary, meaning they said you got kicked out and now you have to find something else.
Yeah, and you have to pick up the pieces and you have to make lemonade from the lemons. And if you're lucky and if you're smart, maybe you can end up doing something that's a little bit more rewarding than what you were doing before. It is a harsher world. There's no question about it.
Well, you know, Susan, I have a lot of friends who had magazine jobs, made a lot of money, were editors at major book companies and the rest. And now they are doing things like writing novels and getting those novels published at, well, let's just say vanity presses of one kind or another. It's not that easy to fall into something that will provide you even with a base lifestyle, unless, of course, you're Susan Crandall and have done all of this stuff and have a lot of friends around.
Yeah, it can be really, really tough. And at this age, and I write a lot about midlifers, they may be helping their kids out. Their
so
kids
what's
are,
midlife like, 35?
Well, midlife, if you're really looking at the actuarial charts, is about 40. But
if you're
I
really
think midlife
looking at...
is a state of mind now. Yeah, okay. If you think you're at midlife, go with it. Yeah. And a lot of people have responsibilities. Maybe they're taking care of aging parents. They have kids who've moved back in the house, or they're trying to help their kids financially. And that can make life tough. But if you can't reinvent your job, that doesn't mean you can't necessarily reinvent your life. Maybe you need to look at the other moments in your life. One of the things I recommend in the book is to take a mental health day from work one day and go off and do something that you love to do. Whether
what if you don't love to do anything else, like me? I mean, I love work, but I don't love to do anything.
I don't
anything.
Believe that for a minute.
No? Huh. Well, I mean, maybe go to a bluegrass festival, but other
you
than
see?
That, yeah. Other than that, I can hardly believe it. And I get depressed when I stay home and watch Law & Order too many times. You know, there's always that sixth grade guilt I should be working on my homework when I, you know, should be doing this kind of thing. We're work creatures. So what about you? I mean, a little bit more about you. I want to come back to the money because I think, you know, it's nice if you have a nest egg and the rest of it. But if you don't and you want to reinvent yourself, either voluntarily or not voluntarily, things cost so much money these days. How do you buy a new car? How do you paint your house? How do you do all that stuff?
Well, I think you have to figure out what it is that moves you, you know, what touches your heart. And it may not be something that costs a lot of money. I mean, what I love to do in my own life is hike and ride my bicycle. And you have to buy a bicycle. But after that, those two things, and you have maybe buy some hiking shoes. But
and
after
a helmet.
That,
yeah.
Yeah, that's true. A really good helmet.
Yeah.
So it's finding things that really make your heart beat a little faster. It could be growing heirloom tomatoes. You know, it could be a whole variety of things. It could be doing volunteer work. My husband drove for our local ambulance corps for 10 years. And you know, that was wonderfully fulfilling work for him. In fact, when he started doing it, he was such an eager beaver that he would actually get up because he'd go on shift at 6 o'clock in the morning at 5:30 and put all of his ambulance clothes on and then go back to bed. So if his beeper rang, he'd be ready to go. But that was a really important thing. Right now, he works as a mentor and a teacher in our local Tuskegee Airmen chapter. So he's found something else that is really important to him and powerful.
You know, there's going to be somebody, Susan Crandall, I'm not going to lie to you. There's somebody who's sitting out there and says, you know, she lives in a nice house on the Hudson. She reinvented herself. She had all of these major jobs in her life, but I'm not her. I suspect, despite the fact that she tells you she's not rich, that she is either rich or is coming from that sort of rich place. That's a sort of not easy thing to describe.
I guess I would say that I come from the saving place. I mean, if there's anything I could say to people who are in their 20s and 30s, it's try, even when it seems impossible, to save some money. Because my husband and I did not inherit any money, started out with a certain amount of money and ended up with enough to have a nice life where we both work but we can live in a nice way. And it's simply because our parents were savers and we kind of stumbled into doing the same thing. And I do write about money for another website. And that's the message that I always want to say to people. It sounds sort of silly to worry about later on in life when you're in your 20s and 30s, but the money that you save then makes such a difference later on.
Well, most people don't understand that at all. Most people don't do that. And so you're sort of talking to, you know, a brick wall in some ways.
Yeah.
So, but you have had some remarkable stories that you've told. Let's go through some of them. And you'll tell us a little about each of them. And these are in your book, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And the book is?
Thinking About Tomorrow, Reinventing Yourself at Midlife.
Okay. The Louisiana banker who quit his job and bought a small town zoo.
George Oldenham is one of my favorite stories. He worked at a bank. He was a vice president. He had a good job, three boys that he and his wife were bringing up. But every day he'd go to work and realize that he was giving business loans to other people, and he wasn't doing what he really wanted to do with his life. He had always dreamed of owning a business, which is a big dream for an increasing number of Americans. And one day he just decided he was going to take the plunge and do it. And he bought a small zoo in their town in Louisiana, took out a business loan, and began running the zoo. And that was about a decade ago, and he's still running the zoo. Good news is it's still doing well. And I remember his wife said that George is much dirtier, works much longer, and is much happier than he's ever been.
So I think part of it is, right, is the fact that we either like or dislike what we're doing. I mean, I love running WAMC. When bankers, I hear a story about a banker who bought a zoo. I said, well, he didn't like banking, and therefore he wanted to run a zoo. But there are, of course, a lot of people who don't need to reinvent themselves because they like what they're at, right?
Yeah.
Now, what about reinventing yourself personally? You know, half of America gets divorced. Half the marriages in America end in divorce. And somebody inevitably says, you know, I need to move on from this. This isn't what I had thought it was going to be, maybe after 20 years, 25 years, the rest of it. How do you deal with personal, you know, reinvention?
Well, hopefully with a bold spirit and a few good ideas. I mean, there in the kind of family section that I wrote in the book, there was a couple who had each had two marriages end. They were in their 50s at this point. She'd been divorced once, widowed once. He'd been divorced twice. And neither of them gave up on love. They put an ad on Match.com, found each other, and are now three times the charm, I guess, happily married. So I think part of it is having a spirit of adventure. And you're right, Alan, it's not going to be easy for everybody. It never is easy for everybody. It's harder for some than for others. But it's more important at that point to somehow find the courage to look around than to throw yourself a big pity party.
Well, you know, Susan, there's in the 2,000-year-old man, there's Dr. Haldanish, who's not really a doctor. And he said, well, one of the things that made him so good as being a doctor is funny, Mel Brooks. And he said, what was the worst case you ever had? A man sat in the corner and just tore paper. And you cured him, sir? Well, yes, I did. He said, how did you cure him? I looked at him and I said, don't tear paper. Now, that is a very funny story, but quite frequently, haven't we sort of become a hedonistic, you say pity party, self-seeking group of people who think it's either fashionable or not fashionable just not to be happy? So suck it up and don't tear paper becomes something that when somebody comes to me and says, well, I say, I think you've got a very good life. Why are you screwing with it this way? I guess you can help me understand that. Do you think that we are a nation that's obsessed by being unhappy?
Not my friends. Yeah, I suppose there are some people. House comes to mind, House MD.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think we're fascinated by miserable people in the media.
Present company excluded?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So, okay. So let's go to the next one that we have here. The Emmy-winning comedy writer who became a singer-songwriter in her 60s.
Yeah, this is the story of Tracy Newman, who's actually also the sister of Lorraine Newman, who was on Saturday Night Live for many years. And Tracy was a comedy writer, and she actually won the Emmy for co-writing the coming out episode of Ellen. And so she had an extremely successful career as a comedy writer. But before she became a comedy writer, she had done a little bit of singing, and it was always tickling around the back of her mind that she wanted to do that creative thing again, both to songwrite and to perform, which was plenty scary for her. And so now in her 60s, that's exactly what she was doing. In fact, before I came here this morning, I received an email of her new CD that's out, notice of her new CD. She writes all her own music. She sings at small venues in Los Angeles, and she's a happy woman. And she doesn't expect to be the next YouTube sensation. She doesn't expect to be topping the Billboard chart, but she does expect to kind of fill her heart with what she's doing. And the next album she's going to do is a children's CD.
Huh. Interesting. You know, we here at this radio station get maybe 500, maybe more, CDs from people who write their own music and who perform their own music. And now, of course, you know, with the internet, there's not an awful lot of places for all of it. So how much of this can be self-deception?
Well, I don't think it's self-deception if you have reasonable goals. As I say, with this woman, she's not thinking she's going to become the next huge sensation. She's not applying to be on American Idol or the Voice. She just wants to do something that feels good to her. And if someone in an audience, when she's singing, she's connected with, that's a really good day. So yeah, I think with self-publishing, whether it's self-publishing music or books or whatever, if you're doing it to become a huge commercial success, that's not likely. It
although,
might happen, it's
although
not
my
likely.
Friend Meyer just writing a book and expects it to do very well. And I think a lot of people who write the classic American novel, sit down and do that, are expecting that this will help them financially in every other way, right?
And that's wonderful if it does happen. And I think it's equally terrific that there is a great option of self-publishing these days.
Yes, indeed.
You know, it used to be called vanity publishing, yeah. And it used to be a little bit of an embarrassment. And now it's you know, you setting your flag in the ground and saying, you know, this is what I've done. And there are ways to reach an audience on your own that just didn't exist before. So I guess it's wonderful if you're looking to make a connection with people. And then it doesn't matter if you're making a connection with hundreds of people or thousands or millions.
Are you judgmental about people who don't try to reinvent themselves in a negative sense?
I don't think so. I mean, I think there are lots of people who are tooling along in life, very satisfied with their families. Either they do love what they do, like you, Alan, or what they do is okay, and it's the road to having the money and ability to do what they really adore in their free time. You know, maybe they're a triathlete, you know, maybe they're a gardener, something like that. So I guess I just want everybody to find a passion and run with it in some aspect of their lives.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about the homemaker who invented a purse organizer, started a business in her garage, and now sells more than $1.5 million worth of product a year.
Yeah, this is a woman who says, I carry a lot of things in my purse. And one day for Christmas, her son gave her a beautiful, expensive leather bag, and she didn't want to take it back. It was from my son, and it was this gorgeous bag. But she said, I looked into it, and it was like a big hole. There was no way to organize my stuff. So she sat down and figured out a purse organizer, which she calls the Pouchy. And her husband ran a business, and I suspect that he may have given her a little bit of counsel, but she'd never done it before. And she started the business in her garage, and she found some place to make these. And she actually went around to stores and knocked on doors and said, will you take these on? And it just grew and grew and grew. And yeah, this last year she sold $1.5 million worth of Pouchies. And she was very conservative through the whole thing. She at one point took out a line of credit. I don't believe she's ever used it. She would not hire anyone until she absolutely couldn't work without anyone. I believe she has 4 employees now, but she's been very, very, very careful all the way in building this business, and she loves it. And I think, you know, it's a double-edged sword. Some days she wakes up and says, "Why aren't I spending more time with my grandchildren?" And sometimes she wakes up and says, "This is amazing."
Well, what is a Pouchie?
It's this little purse organizer that she makes, and you can
put. Could you describe it?
Yeah, it's a smaller. It's almost like a smaller purse in a way that just holds your glasses, your wallet, your lipstick, whatever people have kind of rattling around in the larger purse, so that if you're someone who changes purses and has a number of them, you can just move this from purse to purse and not worry that you don't have important things.
I see. So she had a good idea.
Yeah, she had a good idea.
Everybody has a good idea, right?
Yeah.
But does everybody do something about that good idea?
Yeah.
That's what the issue is. Okay, so how about the TV cameraman? What about him? What happened to him?
This is a guy who worked for one of the network affiliates out west for 27 years as a cameraman. And then in his late 40s, he lost his job. And for a certain number of months, he just sent out resumes and tried to get that same job back again. Well, the TV industry was changing, and that job basically didn't exist anymore. So he had to think about what else he could do. He had also been a race car driver, you know, as an avocation, and he worked on cars. And he became one of the leading Porsche experts in the country. If you're rebuilding a car or, you know, outfitting a car for the racetrack. And again, he's working longer than he ever has. He's probably making less money than he did as a cameraman, but he is enjoying his work and enjoying his life. And he had to make it happen. You know, he had to come up with the idea and make it work.
It's hard to believe that he's making, as one of the world's leading auto mechanics in any field, he's making less money than he was making as a TV cameraman. I've known an awful lot of TV cameramen on the one hand, and then I also know that it's almost impossible to walk into any automobile place these days and get out for a hell of a lot less than $500 or $1,000.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, he deals with a very kind of special segment of the market. He's in Portland, Oregon, and he probably should charge more.
Okay, and how about the woman, the chubby woman?
Yeah, this is a woman who'd been heavy all her life, never could do much about it. And she turned 40, had that aha moment when she saw herself in a photograph and went to the store and had to buy a larger size dress than she'd ever purchased before and said, I need to do something about that. And again, it was all little steps along the way. She just started by changing her diet a little bit, and she lost a little bit of weight. Then she thought, I've got to add something to this. And she started going to the gym, which I think all of us who've gone to the gym the first time remember that bewildering array of shiny equipment. Indeed. And you have no idea what any of it does. Well, she kind of faced that down, figured out how to go to the gym, then again, and lost some more weight, but was kind of losing her momentum. So she hired a trainer just briefly to get her going again and began to talk to some people who were running races. And she became a triathlete. Didn't think she could even complete the smallest possible triathlon the first time, but she did. And what's important to me about Donna's story is that she kept putting goals in front of herself. I don't think there's anything harder than losing weight and keeping it off.
Right.
And she just keeps finding a new reason to stay the course. you know, and follow the path. And, you know, she continues to run races. She's done a full marathon, and she continues to be 90 pounds lighter than she was.
Now, Susan Crandall, that gives me the following question. In reinventing yourself, is there something different when you're reinventing yourself as a man or a woman?
You know, it's interesting. I'm not sure. I don't know the answer to that.
I mean, women in this society have always had to keep themselves attractive, whether we like to say it or not, and this is not an anti-feminist statement. You know, they have a different set of standards than men who can be, you know, paunchy and have a lot of money and do this kind of thing. But women are, you know, we know what we see on television and we know what's out there. I mean, I often watch, as you do, Law and Order, and I see the assistants and say, my God, I worked in the New York City Police Department and I never saw a cop who looked like that, ever.
Yeah, nor
so,
have I.
So what I'm saying is that women who reinvent themselves have to do it in a different way than men who are either forced to reinvent themselves or have enough money and say, now I'm going to reinvent myself. I'm going to be a philanthropist for the rest of my life, or I'm going to do this or that, have a passion. Don't you think?
Well, a lot of social scientists take kind of a different approach to it and say that women have an easier time reinventing because they traditionally in our culture have led a more fluid life. They may have dropped out of the workforce to have kids and then had to figure out how to get back in. And I'm not sure that I buy all of this because I've seen a lot of men be very successful at reinventing. But the conventional wisdom says that women are actually a little bit better at it because they're used to multitasking and they've been kind of in and out of the workforce. So I don't know. I think it's like everything else in life. It's probably very, very individual.
Do you think anybody should go to a shrink in order to learn how to reinvent themselves? In other words, priorities. My father always told me to be a teacher because I would have something to fall back on, you know, and I resented that, blah, 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 blah. All the rest of it that goes on in, you know, in an analytic sort of circumstance. And then, you know, you come out of it and say, okay, now I have the courage to start my own business in my own garage. You think there are people who help you reinvent yourself?
There certainly are. There's
expediters.
I like that word. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, there's a whole genre of life coaches whose mission it is to help people.
Well, some of them are great, but some of them are the biggest phonies I've ever seen.
That's right. And it's, they range from no good at all and
people who had unsuccessful lives themselves and then become life coaches. Yeah. I've always had to knock my head against the wall on that one.
And then I think there are some who are genuinely good at their jobs. And the trick there, of course, is to find the gems, you know, in that pile.
And anybody can call themselves a life coach.
That's right. There's one or two organizations that do certification of that. But, of course, that only says that they went to the effort to get certified. I mean, there's training and there's
some lousy psychiatrists, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they all have MD after their name or whatever. Okay. So men and women have it a little bit differently. And we have all of the trappings of society that can trap us. I mean, you know, women who have been sex objects all of their lives and now have to get a little older and have a little bit different view of what is possible with their lives and letting go of some of the old stuff.
Yeah, and I think you have to start paying a little more attention to function rather than form. I always like to say, I don't look the same in the Lycra on the bicycle as I did 20 years ago, but I can still ride as far. Huh. So, you know, I think to look at what really, really, truly matters, maybe it's a good life lesson in the end.
Huh.
It's function, not form.
Function, not form. Okay, how about your friend Claire?
My friend Claire.
That's an interesting story.
Yeah, she sort of forgot to have a baby.
Right.
And suddenly she was 52 and she decided that this needed to happen. And I actually have two friends. I have another friend who actually gave birth to a baby at 51. Claire wasn't lucky enough to be able to do that. And she had a baby by surrogate. And Connor's now 8 years old. And she's having a wonderful time with him.
Which brings up the whole ethical issue as to whether or not, you know, one who's in their 50s should have a baby. And then you say, okay, that's nice for me. I've reinvented myself. But by the time I'm 70, you know, or the average age of death is for women, I think, is 80 now.
Yeah.
You know, the kid isn't going to be that old.
And I think that's a really valid concern. I've written a couple of magazine articles about having babies after 50. And I kind of went into the reporting with the chip on my shoulder, thinking, you know, doing the numbers just as you have, Alan, and saying, that's not fair to a child. And then I was kind of caught up in the love and the enthusiasm and the commitment of the people that I talked to who were doing this. No one has a baby after 50 by accident. You know, these are all, you know, hard-fought, hard-won kids. And, yeah, you're rolling the dice a little bit. Now, my friend Claire, to go back to her story, yeah, she's a very healthy person, but she went and had, like, a super-duper complete physical before she went through this process as the best shot she could make at assuring that she'd be around. And, yeah, so it's, I think that's something that people definitely have to consider. But it when you meet these people, they want kids in a way that you can hardly understand.
You mentioned before that you were married to another writer. That always leaves back to the reinvention question. If you reinvent yourself, is there the risk that the other person living with you might scratch their head and say, I didn't sign up for this?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that's so true. And because you're, you know, changing the rules of the game, and if you happen to be...
Yes, Mrs. Magazine editor, you know, you were making a ton of money. You decide, and I'm not saying it's you, because obviously you have a very good marriage, strong marriage, but I don't want to do that anymore. And all of a sudden, your husband is sitting there, or your wife, and saying, my God, you know, now I'm going to have to work even harder because she's made this life change.
Yeah, there are certainly ripples that go out into the family, whether it's your spouse or your kids. And, you know, when you change, they're forced to change too. And they're not always with the program. And I think it's really important to talk often and early about what you want to do and try and get your family on board. And it can also be sisters. It can be friends. Friends can be threatened that you're doing something that seems kind of cool and amazing, and they're stuck, maybe by circumstances, right where they were before. And this is all fallout. And you have to figure out, is this change that I want to make worth negotiating for?
Now, Susan Crandall, what about reinventing yourself sexually? Either to become somebody in a different gender or to reinvent yourself and saying, you know, I'm tired of going to bed with this guy every night. I want to try something else now. Do you have any stories there?
Well, that's a traditional midlife crisis.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. Yeah, I do have a story that's not that at all. When I did the book, I spoke to a woman who was born a man and had known all her life that she was a woman. In a male body, did not decide to do sex reassignment surgery until age 50, went to a wedding the week after September 11th, and sat in the reception looking out at the still smoldering remains of the towers and thinking, I need to do what I need to do. And she'd had a successful career as a physician, and she ultimately did have transgender surgery and make about the biggest, scariest change I can imagine, you know, at age 50.
And I take it as you get older, you made reference to this before, your need to have life changes becomes greater before the end, before you reach the great hunting grounds.
The older you are, I think the louder you hear the clock ticking, and you think about if I am going to make a change of any sort, I don't have a decade or two to think about doing it.
So, is there biology involved in this? In other words, do we have some mechanism within us that leads us to demand a life change biologically?
Well, you know, there's one interesting piece of science I've seen that looked at the brains of adolescents, which is a time of kind of great turmoil and change, and looked at the brains of people at midlife and found some similarities in how the brains were wired and firing at those two ages that wasn't happening in the years in between. So
I don't get it. Could you go a little further into that? Maybe I just wasn't.
That they were seeing some changes in brain activity in teenagehood and at midlife that were similar, and wondering whether this, in fact, does foster a need for change.
And what was the potential reason for that? Do we know?
I mean, we don't know. It's an observational thing. We see these similar things happening in the brain of a 17-year-old and a 47-year-old, but not in a 27 or 37-year-old. Does it have to do? Is there a natural bent toward, you know, looking around? I think there are also some social things that play into it. When you get to midlife, you've kind of figured out what you're good at. You've worked for a certain number of years. You know yourself better. I mean, we edited a magazine for women in their 40s and 50s for 6 years, which is still going strong without me. And what we found was that women in focus groups over and over again would say, I have a confidence that I didn't have when I was younger. I may be more aware of my faults, but I'm equally aware of my strengths. I'm comfortable in my skin. I know who I am, and I'm more comfortable with that than I have been before. And if that's true for you, that's a good platform for looking around and saying, am I doing exactly what I want to and should be doing, or is there something else out there I want to try?
So how about political reinvention? Do we find that people, you know, once they reach those checkpoints, may reinvent themselves? In the old days, in the 50s, I think it's at least my impression that men and women, that women in, you know, more traditional sense, went along with a husband when it came to politics.
Yeah.
Now we see these huge gender gaps for Romney, for example, and Barack Obama, Women Forum, and more men for Romney. And do people have the courage now to reinvent themselves politically as they get to those stages you just described?
That's a really interesting question. I can't say anecdotally that I've seen that. You mm-hmm. know, I see people just getting kind of more ossified in whatever their political position seems to be. I would like to think that we had more flexibility and we're still kind of thinking from square one, as opposed to thinking I am a liberal and therefore, or I am a conservative and therefore, or I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican and therefore.
So the we is what I'm thinking about, you
yeah.
know, the we in the days of, you know, crinolines, when women said, we're Republicans, or, you know, we're
yeah.
Democrats. And that almost always meant that
oh.
Papa was calling the shots. And now we see something else. And I'm wondering, just out loud, and it's not what your book covered, but whether or not it's what's happening as women find their own voices.
I think that's probably is true. I remember years ago, my husband and I were traveling in Australia, and we were kind of sampling all the great Australian beers. So he ordered one and I ordered another. And the waitress looked at us and said, that must be really difficult, having two beers, because I was supposed to be drinking the same beer my husband has chosen.
Right.
And I think, decades ago, women who didn't go out and make a living and so forth, often did echo their husbands, although who knows what they did when they went into the voting booth. And I think
sure.
now women, you know, do think more independently.
I'm married to a woman who was in the trenches for over 40 years as a teacher, a college teacher, and then decided the last day, now I'm going to both be an author. She's doing very well with that, so third or fourth book, and also that she was going to be a collage artist. And she's been unbelievable, giving shows all over the place, and she's very good. But what's interesting about it is that not everyone has the wherewithal to make the decision and then to do something about it. In other words, Guy, the vice president of New Paltz, was once interviewed about me. And I always tell a story about how I invented the Legislative Gazette newspaper in a hot shower. And he said, yeah, that's true. He did do that, said my vice president. But think of all the people who had good ideas in the hot shower and never done anything about them. So Your book about how to reinvent your life is basically predicated on not only getting the ideas and the passion, identifying the passion, but then the trick is to do something about it.
Yeah, to have the willingness to pull the trigger. And that's
not only pull a trigger, but then if you've reinvented yourself into a collage artist, to go around and make sure that you get all kinds of shows in a dozen different venues that will show your stuff.
And how did your wife make that happen?
She talked to everybody.
Yeah.
There are days I walk around and I say, Roselle, cut it out. You know, because as a result of her commitment to this,
yeah,
she's got stuff all over the place.
And
worked.
Yeah. Commitment to it, I think, probably grew out of that sort of pilot light inside yourself of confidence, of feeling, I know this is good.
Mm-hmm.
I know this
Absolutely.
Is good. And then, of course, you know, she brings apparently the personality to it of being able to go out and communicate with other people about
and
it.
And the ability.
Yeah.
In other words, if she was lousy at collage, that would really be something
yeah.
else. But she's very good at it.
Then she'd just be a marketer.
Yeah, then she'd just be a marketer. And we've seen plenty of that in our lives, haven't we?
Yeah. 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 But to combine the skills of an artist and a marketer, that's a cool thing.
So, Susan, looking back on your life and your hot showers, what is it that you would have liked to do yourself that you haven't done?
Interesting. I feel so lucky in my life to have been able to do the things that I have been able to do, whether it's travel to a great many parts of the world because it was my job to do so, or to have, you know, a great marriage and a terrific child and now a grandchild. I mean, everybody should have one of those. And I've felt very lucky in those kinds of ways. I mean, I feel pretty complete. And in fact, I feel a little guilty that I don't have this dream out ahead of me. You know, I've made a career shift and a small reinvention myself, that I don't have the, I need to climb Everest next week, or, you know, I need to do some of those things.
Huh. What other stories do you have in your book?
There was a guy who was having terrible back pain.
Yeah, I can relate to this.
Yeah, and he just couldn't cure it. And somehow he got himself to a Pilates class. Well, by taking Pilates, in his particular instance, he not only erased his pain, but grew 2 inches. And he ultimately became a Pilates instructor because he believed so much in the power of that. And it made a big change in his life.
Now, Susan, when you hear these stories, do you have a BS detector? In other words, there's always somebody, if you turn the television on in the middle of the night, I've been known to do that here and there, and you'll see people saying, I lost 70 pounds, or and one after another, or I became beautiful when I wasn't beautiful by using a mineral or doing this. I mean, here you are telling people's life stories and making something out of themselves. How do you detect when they're full of it?
I think you can usually tell. Well, with a weight loss case, for instance, how long have you kept the weight off?
Sure.
and that sort of thing. There's certain ways you can tell that, and you can check in, you can do due diligence on people's business. I mean, there are very specific things that you can do, but I think beyond the kind of fact checking or due diligence, you can hear in their voice whether there's a true passion.
Well, but maybe they're just crazy. I mean, certainly I have met a number of those in my life. Susan, what about the concept of a magazine that deals with life change? Life Change Magazine. Why haven't you started that?
Well, maybe you should start that, Alan.
No,
that
I have enough, like I have enough on my plate. I've got the Legislative
idea.
Gazette and WMC in teaching.
I guess the one, from a business standpoint, the one problem, I think you'd have an eager audience, but the one problem you'd have, it's the same reason there's no divorce magazine, that it is a life stage and people go through it and then they're out the other end and they don't need your magazine anymore.
So that's why there's 1,000 books on divorce, but not any on a divorce magazine, because the subscription would run out.
Yeah. Yeah, people would want it, the single issue magazine.
Who don't you like?
Who don't I like?
Yeah, in other words, what ticks you off?
people who won't get off the dime, who have all the wherewithal, because I see a lot of people in my travels and talking about this who want desperately and truly to change their lives, and they are shackled to a certain degree by family responsibilities. And I guess what ticks me off is people who have money, time, the idea, and everything, and just never do anything about it.
Yeah, there is certainly that. Do you counsel them? Do people come to you and say, look, you've written a book called, you know, Thinking About Tomorrow, Reinventing Yourself at Midlife. Do you ever counsel them about and identify where their passions are?
I would say I talk to them about, I'm not a counselor, I'm a reporter. And I do deeply believe that hearing other people's stories is a way that people learn and discover things about themselves. But I think I'd be the kind of the worst kind of life coach if I said that I really was counseling people. So I'm a communicator. I'm a sharer of stories. And if that helps, that's good.
You're also a website person. You have a website. Your consulting and writing work, Reimagined, sponsored by AARP. What's that about?
Yeah, it's called workreimagined.org, and it's sponsored by AARP and powered by LinkedIn. And it is aimed at people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s who either voluntarily or involuntarily are making a big change in their work life. And there's a job board on it. There's a discussion group where people can share advice.
Let's see if we can reprise. Let's talk about what you have to do to reinvent yourself at midlife. Number one, what do you have to
do? Number one, you have to have the passion for it. You have to have the idea. As you point out, Alan, there are some people who have a very fulfilling life and no reinvention needed. You just hang up your no reinvention needed sign and you're good to go. But you need to feel the itch. And once you've done that, then you have to figure out, how do I get started? And there's a whole group of people who are itchy, but they don't know what that they want to do. And what I suggest for those people is to throw themselves a reinvention weekend, to find a friend or two, and only one or two friends, people that you really trust to talk to you honestly and to think analytically. And get together. If you can afford to go to a B&B overnight, do that. If you can't, find a corner of your house and spend a long day talking about what's important to you. And in terms of work, think about not the job description that you want to have, but what you want to do. Think about verbs, not nouns, in terms of what's appealing. And then once you have an idea, then the tricky part is making it happen. And it may mean investing in yourself. I have a friend who came into a little inheritance, and she was 50 years old, and she said, you know what? I raised my kids. I sent them to college. Now I'm going to college myself, and got a doctorate that she'd always wanted. And it didn't result in a career change, but she had always wanted to go and study music at that level, and now she's done it.
But it has to come from within. I can't tell you how many people have come to me and asked me for my advice, and I tell them exactly what to do, and they don't do it. They just don't do it. So I want to be a college professor. I said, okay, then you have to go and get a PhD, as you just said. No, I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there are people who create models of things they'd like to do, allegedly, but I've always felt that they don't really want to do it. They just want to say they want to do it.
Exactly. I think there's wanting to pretend to do it and really wanting to do it. And maybe the pretending thing feels pretty good to them.
I knew a guy once, his lifelong dream, he was a teacher. Primary school teacher, and he wanted to start his own school. And I went to somebody I knew who had a block of rooms in a middle-class housing project, and I said, all he needs is a place to start it.
Yeah.
And I went back to the guy, and I said, here it is. I have this little present for you. I don't think he's talked to me, had four words for the rest of his life with me. And I went to my great friend, Aaron Matroni, and mentor, a great man, and I said, I just was trying to help. He said, you damn fool. You know, you said, here's the way to do it. So it really, I think the one thing I walk away from you with, Susan, is that you have to do it yourself and not have somebody else tell you what to do.
You're absolutely right. This is the ultimate do-it-yourself project. Nobody can do it for you. You've got to, you know, feel the burn in your belly and you've got to want to act on it. And your friend didn't want it in some way. He wanted to want it.
Yeah, no, he wanted to say he wanted it. Yeah. That is so true. Okay, so now you've got the idea. You've talked to some friends about, you know, how to make it happen. But at what point do you operationalize?
Well, it depends on kind of what your life change is. I mean, we've been talking a lot
in the case
about
of the woman who want to get a PhD, she goes to Columbia and signs up.
Yeah.
Or wherever. Yes.
Yeah. If it's career oriented, I think you go find out what's out there to look at, you know, stick a finger in every pot. Go look at Work Reimagined, the site that I work on.
Work Reimagined.org.
Yeah.
Work Reimagined.org.
Or there's an iPad app that I've just read about and I haven't tried it yet called Unstuck. I love the name. And it is exactly about trying to get people from point A to point B in life change. There's a lovely book called Portfolio Life, The New Path to Work, Purpose and Passion After 50. So, you know, there are a number of resources out there, and the same one isn't going to get you started and get me started and get everyone else started. So, you know, try them all out and see what gives you the wherewithal to move forward. If you're thinking about starting a business, as many, many, many people are doing these days, maybe you want to talk to somebody at the SBA that has a great mentor program where, you know, experienced people will help you. You certainly want to write a business plan, you know, and get some help doing that. If you're looking at a career change, you want to start talking to people in the field that you're thinking about.
Takes a little chutzpah, right?
Does take chutzpah.
Pick up the phone and say, hey, can I come and visit with you to somebody?
Yeah. All of this takes a lot. And I think as you go through life, you get a little bit more. I think the moxie rises as the years go by. And you can make yourself accountable. A lot of experts in this field talk about creating a board of directors for yourself. You know, going and finding maybe a couple of friends, maybe a couple of people in the business world who you really respect, and using them as counselors and as a sounding board. And then, of course, you become accountable to them.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, I've seen plenty of board of directors that you're not accountable to. I am here at WAMC, believe me, and if they think I'm walking into mud, they're going to tell me.
Well, maybe you need to pick as one of your board of directors somebody who's going to, you know, grab you by the collar 6 months down the road and say, what did you do about this life change? Are you working on it?
Yeah.
What's happening? Is anything going on? So you can do that to kind of keep yourself going. And also to test drive some of your plans to find out whether you're smart or crazy. Or crazy like a fox.
We've been talking to Susan Crandall, author of Thinking About Tomorrow, Reinventing Yourself at Midlife. And Susan, the website is?
Workreimagined.org.
Well, this has been a terrific hour. I thank you so much for giving us all this time and for telling us about your work and your reinvention. And it gives a lot of people hope. So thank you, Susan.
Thanks, Alan. It's great to be here.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.